So we are now coming to the very end of the very last sutta that I want to have a look at for this retreat. And this is, as I was saying before, I want to continue talking about those things that actually give rise to understanding, give rise to vijja, how this ignorance of this delusion can be abolished. And I was just before I was talking about how this process is actually experienced when it works properly. And now I want to talk more about the practical side of things, how we actually apply ourselves throughout this process so as to give rise to or abandon delusion at the very end. And this process really is one of the core teachings that we find in the suttas. It's known as the gradual training. And the gradual training shows the whole practice from the beginning, when we start hearing the word of the Buddha, all the way to the end. And this, what we're going to look at now, is a contraction, in a sense, of that gradual training. Slightly different from the usual way it is talked about, but essentially that's what this is about. And this sutta is called Ignorance. And I'm going to probably do a slightly different version from what is on the page here, but I'm going to start with that, and we can have a look at it. Okay. So this goes as follows. Because this is said, the first point of ignorance, because is not seen, such that before this there was no ignorance, and afterwards it came into being. Still, ignorance is seen to have a specific condition. So this is what we're talking about yesterday, about ignorance having no first point. I guess because it is hard to think of what the first point of ignorance could be, but the arising of understanding is more easy to understand how that can come about. Okay, so this is what happens then. So this is the specific conditions for this thing we call delusion, avijja, or ignorance. I say because that ignorance has a nutriment. It is not without nutriment. And what is the nutriment of ignorance? It should be said, the five hindrances. The five hindrances too, I say, have a nutriment. They are not without nutriment. And what is the nutriment of the five hindrances? It should be said, the three kinds of misconduct. The three kinds of misconduct too, I say, have a nutriment. They are not without a nutriment. And what is the nutriment of the three kinds of misconduct? It should be said, non-restraint of the sense faculties. Non-restraint of the sense faculties too, I say, have a nutriment. It is not without nutriment. And what is that nutriment? It should be said, lack of mindfulness and clear comprehension. Lack of mindfulness and clear comprehension too, I say, has a nutriment. Is not without nutriment. And what is that nutriment? It should be said, careless attention. Careless attention too, I say, has a nutriment. It is not without nutriment. And what is that nutriment of careless attention? It should be said, lack of faith or confidence. Lack of confidence too, I say, has a nutriment. It is not without nutriment. And that is not hearing the good Dhamma. Not hearing the good Dhamma, I do say, has a nutriment. It is not without nutriment. And what is that? Not associating with good persons. Right, so this is the whole sequence, and it shows you why avijja, why delusion arises through this whole sequence here. And of course, if the opposite thing happens, right, if you start off at the very beginning with associating with good persons, then the opposite thing happens all the way through. And the opposite happens eventually. You abandon that delusion and they give rise to vijja, or true knowledge, instead. So that's what I want to look at. I want to look at that reverse sequence, starting with good persons and going to the very end, and see, get some understanding what is meant by this sequence unfolding. And I have my little Kindle here, which is very handy. It means I can access this sutras directly without raising my cursor. So, let's have a look at the reverse order of this particular sequence. So it starts off with associating with good persons. And the way that it is talked about here, just to make it clear to you what is going on here, it says, thus, associating with good persons, becoming full, fills up hearing the good Dhamma. Right? So if you keep on associating with a good person, when that factor is fulfilled, becomes full, then that fills up the hearing of the good Dhamma. So what does this mean? And this is actually quite profound, right? This is the very first factor on the path, associating with good persons. You could argue, well, what is the cause for associating with good persons? But this is actually the beginning, yeah? And so who are these good persons, right? Is that just anybody who's kind of kind, or is it, what does it mean? And the Pali word is sapurisa, which means like a true person or a superior person, was one of the translations that Bhikkhu Bodhi used to have before. Superior person, and then the opposite would then be like inferior. So what is a superior person in the Dhamma? A superior person is somebody who has understood the teachings, right? Understood the Dhamma, who has seen things according to reality. Somebody who has something they can share with you, something that you don't know. That is a superior person. So of course, the number one good person, the number one superior person, is of course the Buddha himself. And he is often called the eye of the world, right? He has penetrated to understand things according to reality. And because he has seen things according to reality, he has something that we would like to know about. He has understood happiness, he has understood suffering, he has understood the path to these things. He has something to share with us that is very valuable. And this, of course, becomes then the basis for why you respect somebody who has something profound to tell you. You respect them because they actually have something that you would like to share. You would also like to have access to those things. Just like you go to school, you go to university, you have a certain respect for the teacher, right? Because they have information that you would like to have. You go to school, you know, you want to become a doctor or whatever. Now the professor of medicine, he can tell you how to become a doctor. That's why you respect him. He has access to that information. But that is kind of worldly information. It's nice, of course, to be a doctor, and it's a wonderful thing to be a doctor, but it's still kind of worldly. It doesn't give you access to true, profound happiness in the way the Buddha's teaching does. So if an ordinary teacher is worthy of respect, then of course the Buddha is far more worthy of respect in that sense, because he is a sapurisa. He is a truly good person, or a superior person. This is what it means, that it's associating with those who actually have access to a truth, a profound truth about reality, ideally the most profound truth that there is. And it is fascinating that this is always at the foundation of the Buddhist path. It always comes first. I'm sure you all have, or most of you probably have heard of the idea of the Kalyana Mitta. Mitta is a friend, Kalyana is good, a good friend, right? And who is the real good friend? It's the Buddha, right? Same thing, sapurisa, kalanamitta, same kind of idea, is the kalyanamitta. And it is often said, you know, that there's a very famous quote from the sutta, which you probably have all heard before, which is often kind of, you know, people mention all the time. And this is Venerable Ananda, he goes to the Buddha, and he says to the Buddha, this is half the holy life, right? It is really important, it's half the holy life. Kalyanamitta, spiritual life, half of it, right, is Kalyanamitta. And you may think, oh, he's probably exaggerating, how can it be half of all of that, there's so much other stuff. And then the Buddha says, not so, Ananda, not so. This is everything in the holy life. It's 100%. Right? Why is it that Kalyanamitta is 100%? Does that make sense to you? Is the Buddha exaggerating, perhaps? Maybe he's exaggerating a bit, right? Think the Buddha's exaggerating? Yeah. And I used to think of that, he means kind of roughly 100%, it's very important, right, so he said it's 100%. But actually, when the Buddha speaks, usually he's very precise and very careful in the way he chooses his words. He doesn't say it's 100% if it isn't. If he says it's 100%, it must actually mean that. And that's when you start to understand, you know, you start to reflect, what does this actually mean? And the point, of course, is that unless you have somebody, because we are so fully conditioned as human beings, basically we are the sum of conditioning and influence that work of us, that's basically who we are as human beings. And because we are our conditioning, it means that unless you get some kind of external impulse, which says, okay, you know, which leads in the right direction, you will always tend to be heading in the wrong direction. So that external impulse is absolutely necessary. Otherwise, you're like a ship on the ocean, right? This is what human beings are like. You're the ship on the ocean, a ship that has no rudder, so you have no direction, which means that you are at the mercy, 100% at the mercy of the currents and the winds. You would, wherever the wind blows, the wind comes from the north, you go to the south. The current comes from the east, you move to the west. You are 100% at the mercy of the conditions and things around you, because that's what we are as beings. We are the sum of the conditioning. So that there must be somewhere where this whole thing starts, right? This thing can only start if somebody penetrates to the truth, somebody becomes the eye of the world, and it gives you access to these teachings. Without that, it's almost impossible to get access to them, unless you become a Buddha yourself, right? That's of course the alternative, because that is the only person who actually penetrates this. But remember, becoming a Buddha yourself is very unreliable, because it is more or less by accident that somebody becomes a Buddha. There isn't any path to becoming a Buddha. It is something which happens. Somebody somehow happens to kind of maneuver their way through samsara by cause and effect, and eventually they penetrate things. But it's not. There's no sure path to that. The only sure path is the path laid down by the Buddha. So this shows you why this is so important, right? Why this first step is so fundamental. So if you feel that you have found the profound teaching in the world, and this is what I feel when I read the word of the Buddha, then you know you should be so incredibly grateful, because it is so difficult and so rare to come across these kind of teachings, and you are at the mercy of all the other currents and things in the world, and this is the only way really out of that. So this is why it's at the beginning, and why it is considered one of the absolute foundation stones of the Buddhist practice. If you go to the Anguttara Nikaya, Anguttara Nikaya 1, it has all these kind of basic factors which stand at the foundation of the Buddhist path. Kalyanamitta is one of those. Yonisomanasikara is another one. Appamada is the third one. Samaditti, a fourth one, right? These are all basic things. Without those, nothing can really happen there. So even if the Buddha arrives, if you are completely deluded, you're not going to get it, right? So there's many factors coming together here. And of course, the idea here is that once you associate with somebody like that, you get to hear the real teachings, right? You get to hear the Dhamma. This is what the good Dhamma here refers to. Sad-Dhamma is the Pali word for this. When you hear those teachings, then you start to realize that what is going on here. And this combination of seeing the good person and hearing the good teaching is very powerful. Because you hear the teaching, you see the person who expounds the teaching, and you see that there is a congruity there. It's congruence, right? And what they teach and how they act and how they teach, it goes together. It's not as if they say one thing and then they kind of act in a crazy way afterwards. Crazy wisdom is highly overrated. There's no such thing as crazy wisdom. Wisdom is usually very sane. It makes you sane. It doesn't make you crazy. So basically, these things come together. That's what makes it powerful. You see the Buddha. He acts what he teaches. He teaches the way he acts. And then, of course, once you hear the Dhamma, then you start practicing. What's the next factor? Then you get faith, right? You get this confidence that this is true. If you are ready to hear it, not everybody gets confidence. Somebody will dismiss it, right? It's not right or whatever. It's always like that. We are so different. But if you are the right kind of person, you gain faith. And faith is both an emotional and intellectual thing. It is both the faith of the heart and the confidence of the more intellectual kind of confidence. You know, feeling this is right. And then, of course, once that faith arises, you start applying yourself. So faith, when that becomes full, you gain careful attention, it says here. Careful attention is a Pali word, is yoniso manasikara. Manasikara, attention, I think, is a good translation for that. Manas is mind, kara is from karoti, means to act. So, It is the activity of the mind, where the mind kind of attends to, right? Which sense space, how it attends to whatever comes in through the senses. This is yoniso manasikara. Yoni, but literally means womb, that's what it means. So it is it's kind of a tension which has to do with the source of things, right? The womb is like the source of something. So it is a... it's actually more like an idiom anyway. So it means like wise attention is a good translation of this word. So what does it mean to have wise attention? And what it means is that in a very general sense, it means that whenever you are looking at something, whenever you do something in the world, whenever you are perceiving anything, you're perceiving it in a skillful and wise way. That's essentially what it means. There's one very interesting sutta that we find a couple of places in the Anguttara Nikaya. And this is one case where it's Venerable Ananda, he goes to Venerable Sariputta. Venerable Sariputta and Venerable Ananda were very good friends. If you're not aware of this, Venerable Sariputta was the right-hand man of the Buddha, the wisest one after the Buddha himself. And Venerable Ananda was the attendant of the Buddha. And they happened to be very close friends. And so Venerable Ananda, he goes to Venerable Sariputta and he asks him, what is the difference between a person who attains Nirvana and one who does not attain Nirvana? Right? Very interesting question, right? And so that's all we need to know. You know that. The rest of the path follows as a consequence. And what Venerable Sariputta says, and it's only found in a couple of suttas, the Buddha also says this in another place. What he says is that a person who understands these perceptions lead to decline, these perceptions lead to stability, these perceptions lead to improvement, and these perceptions lead to breakthrough, that person will attain Nirvana. The person who doesn't understand those things is a person who will not attain Nirvana. It's as simple as that, right? All you have to do is choose your perceptions with care. And if you choose how you look at things in the world, if you choose all your perceptions in the right way, like in daily life, right? You're wandering around. And if you have enough mindfulness to understand how you're looking at things in ordinary life, how you're looking at the people around you, and then instead of just allowing things to be automatic, you are aware this perception is going to lead in the wrong direction, right? For example, we're talking about before about enemy or friend. If you look at somebody straight away, you see them as an enemy, then you know that not far from that is going to be the arising of some unskillful thought, perhaps. So you see, this perception is dangerous. It leads to decline. And with enough mindfulness, with enough awareness, you can change and you can actually look at things differently. So the whole Buddhist path, one way of looking at the Buddhist path, is about what choices you make in your perceptions, from moment to moment, from day, from minute to minute, from day to day. How do you choose your perceptions in life? And by carefully always monitoring your perceptions and always, taking the bad ones and expelling them, and then giving rise to positive perceptions, that's all you have to do. If you keep on doing that long enough, you get to Nirvana, right? It's a nice way of looking at the path. Of course, it sounds easy, but of course, in reality, it's not so easy. It's difficult to have enough mindfulness. Sometimes it's difficult to know which perception is bad, which is good. You have to be able to tell the difference. Sometimes it's hard to substitute perceptions because you have to have an alternative to put into place, right? So you need to develop other perceptions. So you have the shelf of perceptions up there, and you have developed all these positive ones. So when you see the bad one coming, you can pull down the positive one, the metta or the compassion or whatever it is. So all of these things have to fall in place. But essentially, the path can be understood as just choosing perceptions in a skillful way, all the way through, from the beginning to the very end. I don't know, I find it very fascinating. And one of the things that you do find in the suttas is precisely, if you go to the Anguttara Nikaya, it's famous for this, it talks a lot about the development of perceptions. So a lot of suttas about how to develop your perception, that falls into line with this. So this is one way of understanding yoniso manasikara. Yoniso manasikara means, it's very similar to being, to appamada, to be heedful, right? To be careful, to be wise about things, to understand what leads in the right direction, what leads in the wrong direction. And then yoniso manasikara is starting to work out. So that is the Yonisomanasikara. Then, what happens then? Well, if Yonisomanasikara being filled up, then that leads to mindfulness and clear comprehension. That's the next one there. And here I think the emphasis is on clear comprehension, and that is often the case when these two are mentioned together. The emphasis is actually on clear comprehension itself. So what is clear comprehension? The Pali word is sampajanya or sampajano. And the idea behind sampajanya is very similar to Yonisomanasikara we were saying before. Clear comprehension means that you know, mindfulness itself is kind of neutral. Mindfulness just means being aware, right? Knowing what is happening in the present moment. But that is not enough. If you are just mindful, if you know, yeah, this is happening, that is happening, it's not enough to overcome the defilements. You know, it may help a little bit, at least you are aware of what is going on, but it doesn't actually overcome the defilements. There is another nice sutta found in the Sanghita Nikaya, where somebody says something like, oh yeah, you know, when I get angry, I'm just mindful. And then somebody replies, I can't remember if it's the Buddha or not, but somebody replies, no, it is not by mindfulness that you overcome anger. It's by metta that you overcome anger. And this is an important point. Mindfulness is of course, essential, because you have to know what is going on, but it's not enough. Mindfulness is only one fact that is important. And the other fact is that what you see here is sampajanya, clear comprehension. Clear comprehension means that you know that what you're doing is suitable, it's right, it is appropriate, especially for what it means. Sampajanya is explained in the commentaries, and sometimes it's interesting to know what the commentaries say. And the commentary says there's four factors of sampajanya, and these four factors are called, they are purpose, suitability, and resort and non-delusion. Purpose, suitability, resort and non-delusion are the four factors of sampajanya. And they're quite interesting to have a look at these four comments. Sometimes I like, some of the commentaries are very useful, and I think this is one case where it's kind of interesting, because sampajanya in its own right doesn't mean all that much. So purpose, right? You know the purpose, why you're doing something. Why are you saying something? Why are you acting in a certain way? Why are you even thinking in a certain way? You understand the purpose of that. So, you know, the classic examples are always around monastics. So as a monastic, you know, you are supposed to go for alms sometimes. You go for alms into the local village to receive food from the lay people. And this still happens in Asia to the present day, people do this. And if you go to India, and many monks have now been to India, and they go for alms, they just go down to a village, right? And the village out of the blue, and they bring their alms bowl out, and everybody in India, straight away they understand what they're supposed to do, and they give you food. Isn't that kind of nice? It's very beautiful, isn't it? All you have to do is, if you look like a monk, of course, hopefully you are a monk as well, but if you look like a monk, and you kind of have the right behavior, you go down the street, people will just give you food. This is kind of the Indian tradition. If you are, somebody who's a spiritual person, they will support you regardless. And this happens all over the Buddhist world as well. But when you do that, you have to know the purpose, right? The purpose is, I'm going into the village to get alms food. I'm not going around to kind of look at, you know, all the nice advertisements or the pretty girls or whatever. That's not the point, right? Because if you do that, you know that it will lead to problems. So by understanding, by having sampajanya, and by having clarity on what you're doing, you're avoiding the arising of defilements in the mind. This is the purpose of this. So you're clear about what you're doing. It's very similar to Yonisomanasikara we're looking at before. You know why you're doing something. Is it appropriate, right? And then the suitability. Suitability is very closely related to that. If you know that today there will be a festival in the village, right? They're going to have some kind of big party or something. Okay, it's the wrong day to go to that village. Or go to another village for alms instead. Because, you know, it's not suitable. So this is the thing. The idea here is just to do those things that don't lead to defilements, but lead away from defilements. That lead to a mind which is steady and which isn't kind of, manipulated by these defilements all the time, being upset, being, desiring things. That's really all it is. But the two last factors of as spoken of in the commentaries, is what is called resorta. And resort, gochara is the Pali word for that. Gochara literally means go is cow. Chara is basically like behavior or hangout, right? So hangout for the cows, which of course is the pastures, right? It's the kind of the field, that's where cows hang out, so they can graze or whatever. And so the pasture, what is the pasture for anybody else or for a monastic? Again, this refers to monastics, but it is applicable in lay life as well. So what is the pasture for a monastic? Yeah. What is the resort? And of course, the first type of resort that we're going to talk about is the people you are hanging out with. Who are your friends? Where do you go for your alms around? Do you go for alms around in some dodgy place, right? If you go to the red light district on alms round, that's considered no good. Or if you go to some kind of, you know, place where there are bandits or robbers or whatever, it's considered no good. If you go to, you know, a place where there's too much sensuality whatever sort, it is no good. So you hang out with people who are roughly on the same wavelength as you, who think like you, right? Where you will not actually give rise to any unnecessary defilements and problems. So this is the first kind of gochara, the people you're with. And there's plenty of examples in the suttas of monks who got a bad reputation because they were hanging out with the wrong people then. So even sometimes even arahants, right, for the awakened ones, did that because out of compassion, not because they could get defiled, of course, but out of compassion. So this is the first thing. But the second thing about gochara, and this is what the commentary is more on about, is your meditation object. So the gochara of a meditator or a monastic is supposed to be the four satipatthanas. That's where you're supposed to hang out, four satipatthanas. And what the commentaries say, and I don't really agree with this, but what the commentary said is that you should always have your meditation object in mind. I don't think that's correct. I don't think there's any evidence for that in the actual suttas. And I know on a few occasions some monks have tried to do this, and it sometimes it led to some very disastrous results. There's one of my fairly good monastic friends called Benedikt Nalle, who is a German monk who does all this comparative research on the Sutta, very nice monk. And he is well known for being a good meditator and all these kind of things. And he decided he was going to try this. He's going to, you know, always be aware of the breath, right? So he walked out of alms round being aware of the breath. And there's a certain, usually when you go on alms round, there's a certain route you take, a certain family that might support you. And suddenly he was walking on, and suddenly he didn't know where he was anymore, right? He had gone down the wrong street somewhere, finding himself on the wrong side of town. Why? Because he was watching the breath. He had no idea where he was going. And the idea here is that if you do meditate, and your mindfulness is very strong, the problem is that you know the breath is so subtle that if you are fully aware of the breath, you can't really be aware of anything else. So you walk down the wrong street, and then you have no idea where you end up as a consequence. So I don't think that is appropriate. I think the commentary there goes too far. I don't think there is any evidence in the suttas for suggesting that you should always keep your meditation object in mind. Rather, what you should do is have enough mindfulness and clear comprehension to know whether what you're doing is suitable or not. If it is suitable and appropriate, that is really what you have to do now. And the last factor of a clear comprehension, according to the commentary, is called non-delusion. And this is the idea of always having in mind that whatever you do, it has got nothing to do with a self, right? There is no self behind this. It's a selfless activity going on. But this, again, is very profound. It is something that is really only possible once you become a stream enter, right? Once you see these things fully. And before that, it is very hard to live up to this kind of high standard. 100%. So the main point here is you know why you're doing things and what you're doing. And, you know, again, many of these things I talked about is about monastic life, but of course lay life is in many ways the same kind of thing. Why are you doing things? And of course one of the important things in any kind of life is to make everything you do part of the spiritual path. Sometimes people say, oh, I feel like schizophrenic, right? When I go back home, I do all this kind of worldly things, and I go on retreat, and I practice my meditation practice, right? And I feel like I'm kind of just two different worlds, right? And my kind of spiritual life is one thing, my worldly life is something else. But that is exactly what you should try to avoid. This shouldn't be two different worlds. Everything should be supportive of the spiritual practice. So in your ordinary life too, make the ordinary life into something positive, something that supports your spiritual practice. If you have to go to work, don't just work for money, right? Work because it is work as an act of charity as well. Think about your customers, think about your co-workers, think about, you know, how you are supporting something but through your work. And if you get a paycheck on top of that, great. But you know, you're actually the real, an important part of the motivation is actually because you're helping other people. It's great if you are in a profession that cares. It's wonderful because it makes it easier if you are a psychologist or you are a doctor or a nurse or, you know, or a teacher or whatever. All of these professions are wonderful because you are. If you use that profession in a skillful way and you remember that you're doing it for out of compassion and kindness for others, it can become very powerful. And you get money on top, wonderful, great, but that becomes only like an additional benefit in a sense. And then the same thing with family life, right? It's how we live the family life that is important. And you can do it skillfully, unskillfully. Yeah. So this is all about sampajanya, having clear comprehension of why you're doing things. And then things start to become very powerful if you do things in the right way. Yeah. Okay. So, that is a little bit about clear comprehension, and when clear comprehension fills up, restraint of the senses become full. This is the next one, you start to fill up the restraint of the senses. And you can probably understand why now, because if you are very skilled in having clear comprehension what you should be doing and what you shouldn't be doing, it means that the defilements don't give a chance to arise. And because the defilements don't arise, it means you have sense restraint, right? The senses are kind of kept out of harm's way, so to speak. So again, remember here that the problem with a word like sense restraint, that when you hear that word, you think, yeah, I've got to use willpower, right? Restraint, it means power, it means force, it means I'm going to kind of control my senses in this way. But remember that the words here, remember these are translations, right? And to understand what these things actually mean, often you cannot go necessarily by the meaning that these words have in English. If you follow the meaning in English too slavishly, you will not always get the point. Because restraint can mean many things, right? There are many ways of restraining, and willpower is actually only one way. The other way I was talking about before was the way of wisdom power. You try to be wise about things, and when you are wise, the restraint happens as a matter of course. Not something that you do through willpower, it's something that arises because you are perceiving things in the right way, you're thinking about things in the right way, you're using wisdom instead. This is the real restraint of the Buddhist path, and there are actually sutras that make it very clear that this is what is meant by restraint. And one of the classic sutras is the Dvaita-Vitakka Sutra, the two kinds of thought, Majjhima Nikaya number 19, if you want to check it out. And in there, the Buddha talks about right kind of thinking and the wrong kind of thinking. And then he explains how he himself, before he got his full awakening, what he did to be able to give rise to the good kinds of thought and to put aside the bad ways of thought. And everything he does is a wisdom practice. What he says is that if I think in this way, it will lead to my suffering, lead to the suffering of others, lead to the suffering of both. If I think differently, it won't give rise to suffering. If I think in this way, it will lead to the destruction of wisdom, right? Panya Nirodhika is the term he uses. Panya, wisdom, Nirodha, a cessation. It will lead to the cessation of wisdom. It's terrible, isn't it? It's nice. I mean, to me, the idea of wisdom is such a wonderful word. Wisdom is like everybody wants to be wise. Of course they want to be wise. Being wise means to understand the difference between what we should be doing and what we shouldn't be doing. Being wise means moving towards happiness. It means being able to deal with problems, right? Knowing how to deal with people in the world, all these kinds of things. Wisdom is such a wonderful thing. If something leads to the cessation of wisdom, it's by definition incredibly bad, right? So this is what he's saying there. These unwholesome thoughts actually lead to a cessation of wisdom. And then he said it is away from Nirvana. And it's also, he said it has to do with pain and suffering. Agata. yeah, whatever, I can't remember the Pali term, but so, and the Buddha says, all I have to do is to know this, and when I know this, the bad thinking declines and disappears as a consequence. If you fully understand that something is suffering, it automatically stops. Right? And the example that I like to use is a very obvious example. If you're in your house, in your home, right, and you're in your kitchen or whatever, you're cooking or whatever you're doing, and then by accident, there's a hot plate on, right, and you put your hand by accident on the hot plate, right, and straight away, your hand kind of comes back, right? You don't have to think, oh, should I remove my hand or not, right? It's not a very difficult decision, it just happens automatically, it's an automatic reaction. And it's exactly the same thing if you understand that anything is real suffering, right? Same thing with the thoughts. If you have penetrated to the idea that this is a problem, you understand that fully. You don't have to think, should I remove my mind from these thoughts? It just happens automatically and the thoughts just stop. So, but you have to contemplate that. Why are these things problematic? Why are they suffering? The more powerful you understand that, particularly thinking thoughts of anger, right? It's pretty obvious in some ways, but when you are a kind of obsessed by anger, it's hard to see it. But you can start to see that. But even things like attachments, right? And sensuality to some extent, the same problem arises there as well. So once the more powerful you see that, this is an important part of the contemplation of these teachings, to understand the danger in these things. When you remember that, the mind just withdraws by itself. This is why I also like the word repulsion before, because that's exactly what happens. The mind is repelled by dukkha, so it is repelled, right? And this is how you lead to this liberation. Same kind of idea behind that. So that is sense restraint. It's a very, all of these things are very, very, very interesting areas of Dhamma. They really deserve a lot more time than what we can give it now. But it's all very, very fascinating here. Okay, so restraint of the senses. And when that fills up, the next thing that happens as a consequence is that the three kinds of good conduct fill up, right? And that's fairly obvious. The three kinds of good conduct are body, speech, and mind. So if you are able to restrain your senses, it means that your mind becomes nice and even. You don't have these kind of big waves in the mind anymore. The basic defilements of ill will and desire that die down, and you get nice, even mind state. So you have this very profound good conduct, you know, your virtue is becoming very deep at this particular stage. So this is what is happening here. And then what happens, based on that, and this, you don't have this on your sheet of paper, because it is slightly different, this one here. Once you have the three kinds of good conduct is filled up, that leads to the fulfillment of the establishments of mindfulness, the Satipatthana. Right? And this is important because it means that Satipatthana, I was just looking at this other sutta before. I said that meditation is an automatic process, right? It is based on virtue. And here you are seeing just that. The Satipatthanas, the establishments or the applications of mindfulness are based on virtue. This is exactly the same thing you find here. Right? So once the three kinds of good conduct are established, that is what makes mindfulness possible. That's what makes meditation possible. Prior to that, meditation is very weak. It can be nice, it can feel good, but it's not really the real meditation the Buddha is talking about. The meditation the Buddha is talking about is always meditation founded on virtue, founded on the three kinds of virtue. And you see this throughout the suttas. It is one of the things that you see in the Satipatthana Sanyutta. The Buddha says again and again that you practice Satipatthana based on two things. Sila is one, the other one is Ujjukaditti. Ujjukaditti. Ujjuka means strength, ditti is view, right? Straight view. These are the two foundations on which you practice Satipatthana. So at this point, Satipatthana becomes possible. So what is this Satipatthana practice about? And this is, I think, an important point. If you look at the other version of this, which I was reading out before, I was saying that if you have the three kinds of bad conduct, it leads to the five hindrances, right? Now, if you have the three kinds of good conduct, it leads to Satipatthana. The Satipatthana is the opposite of the five hindrances. So the purpose of Satipatthana is, its main purpose on the Buddhist path, is to abandon the five hindrances. This is what it's all about. So Satipatthana practice, you know, and so it doesn't matter, you know, some people like to call it Vipassana practice. Other people would say that the Patthana is Samatha practice. Either point can be argued very easily from the suttas. Actually, it's actually easy to argue the point that it's Samatha than Vipassana. Vipassana is actually much more difficult to argue. But that it is Samatha practice is very easy to argue from the suttas. And so, because of that, the purpose here is to remove the last remainder of the five hindrances, so that, and take the mind towards Samadhi. We'll see that in a second. That is the real purpose of Satipatthana. And become very clear when you see it in a structure like this, and you see how it works together. And again, if you look at Satipatthana, the Kaya Nipassana is all about the body contemplation, right? So it's overcoming attachment to the body. And then you have the feelings, and the mind is all about the defilements of the mind, how to overcome those things. And the last one, the Dhamma Nipassana, is the one which is most interesting of all. Because there, what you're doing is you're looking in detail at the defilements, understanding what is a defilement. What is not? When is the mind defiled? When is it not? You may think it's obvious, but it's not as obvious as you think, because the defilements can be very subtle, right? So a full understanding of the defilements of the mind actually takes insight. It takes looking at the mind, coming to know yourself, right? This is a certain type of insight to understand yourself. And this is the kind of insight you get in this Satipatthana. And as you gain the insight into your own defilements, only when you know what they are, can they be abandoned. And the other thing to know then is the cause for these defilements. Why are they there? Once you know the cause, you can abandon the causes. And when the causes are abandoned, eventually you want to get to the point where they don't even arise again at all in the future. All of these things, I want you to understand. So, is this Samatha or is it Vipassana? It's both, right? You understand the defilement, then you abandon it, your mind becomes peaceful. All of this happens through breath meditation. All you have to do is watch the breath, and this thing happens as a matter of course. And if it doesn't, then after you come out of breath meditation, you review what happened, and you can see the defilements disappear, and you can see how the whole process works. That's when you get insight into the process and what is going on. So Samatha and Vipassana are always going together. They're not separate things at all, as far as I can see. Yeah. So this is Satipatthana practice, and this is, I think, it's one of those points that is so clear when you start reading the suttas, that Satipatthana and Samadhi, they are one coming after the other. You do Satipatthana in order to get to Samadhi. You look at the Noble Eightfold Path, right? Practice number 7, Samma Sati, Satipatthana. What does it go to? It goes to Samma Samadhi. Right? It is not random. It is not just two factors at the end of the path, one kind of randomly jumbled together. There is a causal relationship, and this causal relationship is pointed out in many, many places in the suttas. Satipatthana actually leads to Samma Samadhi. You find the same thing across in many other places. You find it in the five indriyas. The five indriyas show you that the satindriya, the faculty of mindfulness, leads to the samadhi indriya. You find it in the bhujangas. The bhujangas, the sati sambhujanga, these are the factors of awakening. Yeah? The factor of awakening of sati leads through these other factors of awakening, which are dhammavichaya, contemplating the Dhamma, then to energy, is that right? Energy, and then piti, prasadi, samadhi, upeka. Again, it's the same process that happens there. You see the sati, mindfulness, leading to a samadhi. This is one of those things you see again and again in the suttas, which are always there. The purpose of all this is to take you to samadhi. So that is the, in brief, how the Satipatthanas work and their purpose and why they are found right here in the gradual training. To abandon the hindrances and then to move the mind towards samadhi. And then, the next one, it says, the four foundations of mindfulness, or the four applications of mindfulness, when they become full, then they fulfill the seven factors of awakening. These are the Sambhujangas. And as I was just saying, the factors of awakening are all about samadhi practice. If you start to look carefully at the factors of awakening, the first one is mindfulness, right? Mindfulness means, in this case it can mean different things, but it means basically satipatthana practice. It can also mean like just recollection of the Buddha. It's an anusati, a recollection. And then from that, you have the dhammavicaya. Dhammavicaya, the investigation of dhammas. Very similar to the last factor of satipatthana. Dhammavicaya means understanding which factors in your mind, which qualities in your mind are wholesome, which are unwholesome, which are dark, which are bright, which leads on the path, which leads away. So again, it's the ability to understand your mind in great detail and then take it beyond the problems and move it towards the positive states. And from that comes energy. When you abandon those last those things, energy arises in the mind. And energy usually comes with pamujra, with the gladness, right? Here you see energy is there, but gladness is also there. But we talked about joy before. And from that joy comes the piti, right? I'm sure you recognize the sequence already. It's very similar to the sequence we're talking about before. Comes the piti, which is the rapture. From the rapture comes the tranquility, pasadi, right? Exactly the same sequence we're talking about before. From the pasadi, he goes straight to samadhi. It skips the factor of sukha or happiness we're talking about before, comes the samadhi. From the samadhi comes the upekka, which is the evenness of the mind. And this evenness of mind is what you gain when you go very deeply into samadhi. Some of the deepest aspects of samadhi where you find the upekka of the mind. So all of these things, right, you recognize them as the factors of meditation. The meditation factors that eventually take you all the way to the unification of the mind. So that is what the seven factors of awakening are all about. They concern the samadhi aspect of things. And then, when you have that samadhi, it says here, that becomes the nutriment for true knowledge and liberation. And in this way, true knowledge and liberation become filled. True knowledge is vijja. Right? It's the exact opposite of what we're talking about before. Avijja is the ignorance or delusion. This is vijja happening right here. So vijja arises. And again, as I was talking about before, when vijja arises and avijja is dispelled, then the whole reverse sequence of dependent arising happens. The cessation mode. One ceasing, and then gradually, stage by stage, everything ceasing, all the way up to dukkha itself. Suffering comes to an end. You are liberated. Hooray! Liberation! At last! Right? This is what it feels like. And that's you're liberated. No more dukkha! And of course, that sounds good, doesn't it? No more dukkha sounds really great. And of course, no more dukkha means no more dukkha in a very different way from what you think it means. You know, most people think no more dukkha means, you know, not getting sad and upset and this kind of thing. But it means no more dukkha in a very, very profound way. And so there's no more dukkha in the very real sense. So that is how it all works out. And then there's this nice simile which comes here, which I maybe read out as well, because it's a very nice way of thinking about these things. Why one thing filling up another? You can imagine it takes a while, right? Because you start off with being with good people, and then that gradually fills up here with a good dharma. That gradually fills up faith, right? That gradually fills up yoni soma nisikara. So all of this, you have to sustain it, right? Sustain, sustain, sustain. So that each thing fills up stage by stage. And this is the simile that the Buddha gives for this. Just as when it is raining and the rain pours down in thick droplets on a mountaintop, the water flows down along the slope and fills the clefts, the gullies, and the creeks. These being full fill up the pools. These becoming full fill up the lakes. These becoming full fill up the streams. These becoming full fill up the rivers. These becoming full fill up the great ocean. Thus there is a nutriment for the great ocean. In this way it becomes full. So too, associating with good persons, etc., becomes the nutriment, eventually, gradually, stage by stage, for true knowledge and liberation. This is how they become full. Right? So it's this beautiful stage-like process whereby it begins with the raining on the mountaintop and eventually that fills up the ocean itself. Which is true, right? If the ocean only evaporated, there was never any replenishment, eventually the ocean would go drier. But because the rivers, because it is a closed, it's really a closed system, right? The water just goes round and round. But this is how it becomes filled up. In the same way, gradually you kind of fill up all those good qualities by practicing in the right way. So, there you are. That is the gradual training for you in grief. Very powerful, very beautiful training, and it goes often to show, if you think about this training, it shows you roughly where you are on the path, right? There are all these factors there, and you think to yourself, okay, this is where I'm at, this is where I have to do my work. And also, it shows you that the basic nutriment at the root of this is seeing good people and then hearing the true Dhamma. So how can we go about seeing good people and hearing the true Dhamma? How can we find these good people, right? And sometimes it's more or less by accident. Sometimes you come across somebody, you feel a teaching, the real teaching. You come into their presence and you feel that this is right. This is somebody who has the right qualities. This is what I felt to someone like Ajahn Brahm, and I took Ajahn Brahm as my teacher. He is somebody who really has understood things. And I have been with him for 20 years as a consequence of that. And of course, the other way, not just the teachers, you know, teachers, ordinary teachers, but the other way of being around good teachers is just to read the suttas. When you read the word of the Buddha, when you read the suttas, you don't have to read much. Maybe you have your favorite sutta, maybe you have the Dhammapada, right? And you read a verse of the Dhammapada every now and again. And when you do that, as I said before, you are in the presence of the Buddha, right? You are in the presence of real teachings. And you have the Saparisa, the real people, are right there. In fact, if you really want to have a reliable teaching, the best kind of teaching is always the suttas, because that will always be very reliable. If you go to, you know, monks or nuns or lay teachers or wherever they are, there's always some degree of uncertainty about them. But the Buddha, he had it right, right? If the Buddha didn't have it right, we'd be in serious trouble. If the Buddha got it all wrong, then there is not much hope. So we have to assume that the Buddha got it right. And the more I read these teachings, the more powerful they seem to me. So that has kind of been the basic foundation of everything. Otherwise, everything collapses as a consequence. So you always come back to these basic things. That's where we find our basic nourishment in the suttas, in the teaching of the Buddha. And that basic nourishment, when you keep on nourishing, right? These are called aharas in the Pali. It means food or nourishment. When you keep on nourishing the roots, and the tree becomes beautiful, right? It grows up, becomes larger. But the actual nourishment happens at the roots. And then things happen as a consequence. There's a beautiful simile I was taught by Ajahn Chah, Adam Shah, who was one of the greatest meditation masters in Thailand in the 20th century. He was, of course, Ajahn Brahm's teacher in Thailand. And he says, it's kind of counterintuitive, but he says that apparently, this is what I'm told, I've never met him, but he said that all you have to do is you kind of have to sow, sow the mango seed, right? And once the mango seed is sown, the mango tree comes. And when the mango tree kind of arises, the mango tree becomes large. All you have to do is you have to sit at the root and wait for the mangoes to fall down. Right? And one day you're sitting there, sitting with your hands like this, right? The mango comes, okay. And you take the mango with you and you go off. And that mango is awakening. It's understanding reality according to what it is. Just have to wait for it to happen. So our job is always to put the basic causes into place. Do what we can with the basics. Understand the teachings. Practicing it with sincerity. And if you practice it with sincerity, all you have to do is wait. You sit down in your meditation, completely aware and mindful, absolutely patient. And then the mango, eventually one day, it will come to you. Wow, a mango. Happiness at last.